Good afternoon, everybody. We'll get started. As always, we've got a lot of things to do today, and we are planning to continue into the evening as well. So we're going to start with Representative Sundin. I'm embarrassed that I don't know how to pronounce your name, but thank you. I'll know now. Representative Sundin, House File 861. So, first of all, actually, members, before we start with that, do we have a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Ward moves to approve the minutes of March 12, 2013. Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Okay. So I'll move Representative Sundin's bill. I'll move that House File 861 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And Representative Sundin, welcome to the committee, and go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple comments before I introduce the testifiers on this bill. Every family, sooner or later, has been touched by the tragedy of suicide, and that includes mine. About 30 years ago, I lost a brother to suicide, and I don't know if it was preventable or not. In recent years, I've lost several neighbor kids because they didn't know how to deal with the stress of maybe losing a girlfriend or some financial issues that came up, and it's just a tragedy for every neighborhood, every family touched by this, and whatever we can do to prevent this occurring at any point, I think it's our moral obligation to do so. There's also a financial portion to this. I've been speaking with some of the representatives from the National Guard, and every time a National Guard soldier takes his own life, there's a price tag attached to that in life insurance and ongoing care of the family, that type of thing, of about $500,000 per death. So this is not only the right thing to do, the moral thing to do, but it makes some financial sense if the military were to utilize this program as well. So given that, I thank you for your attention and, on this matter. I have testifiers David Lee from the Carrollton County Public Health and Human Services and Mark Cuppy from Canvas Health to talk about Text for Life.
All right. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Lee, are you Mr. Lee or whoever's first? Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Mark Cuppy. I'm a licensed psychologist and the CEO of Canvas Health. In relation to this bill, Canvas Health is a community mental health center that operates mobile crisis services in Anoka County and Washington County, as well as we operate the Crisis Connection, which is the 24-hour, 365-day-a-year crisis line center. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention reported that in 2010, Minnesota had 606 deaths by suicide. That was the ninth leading cause of death in the state. That's five times higher than homicide, and it was almost 200 deaths more than traffic accidents caused for that year. The U.S. Surgeon General and the National Strategy for Suicide Prevention have as one of their new objectives to promote the adoption of zero suicides as an aspirational goal for healthcare and community support systems. We would like this bill to be a Minnesota initiative towards zero suicides. Suicide is a preventable event. Let me say that again. Suicide is a preventable event. This bill is about both prevention and intervention. The prevention component is about education, training, awareness, and understanding the risk for suicidal behavior. The intervention component is about what we can do at critical moments in time. There is a 5 to 10 minute window where someone has usually moved from being at risk for suicide to being in a suicidal crisis. In that moment of crisis, we know that having someone available to them is the most critical opportunity we have to intervene and save a person's life. Making someone available anytime and anywhere can be achieved through this bill. Texting has become the modality of communication for young adults more than phone calls or emails. And unfortunately, Several of the adolescent suicides in the past few years in Minnesota have been in the process of texting friends or posting messages on Facebook about their feelings right before they suicided. Texting as a suicide intervention provides immediate and accessible opportunity for someone to get help at those critical times. Many people, especially youth and young adults, will not call a crisis line. We have learned, however, they will text. At Crisis Connection, we average 8 to 12 phone calls a month on our national suicide prevention line. With the new project Text for Life, we have been averaging 400 texts a month. Having the Text for Life number programmed in advance in a phone is much more effective than looking for that crisis number on a piece of paper or business card you are handed by a professional. With this bill, a touch of one button on your phone can bring you in contact with a trained crisis counselor immediately and from virtually anywhere in the state. I ask you please support this bill and contribute to saving the next 600 lives at risk for suicide in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coopy. Appreciate it. Another testifier, Mr. Lee.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dave Lee. I'm a licensed psychologist, marriage and family therapist, and independent clinical social worker. I currently serve as director of Carleton County Public Health and Human Services and have had the opportunity to work with a number of people in pulling together a new way of dealing with the rising rates of suicide and developing Text for Life. With the help of initial funding from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, SAMHSA Division, and with the additional assistance of the University of Minnesota Duluth Medical School's Center for Rural Mental Health, we've been able to see this program develop fairly rapidly. Although the initial project was designed for the seven counties in northeastern Minnesota, we have seen young people in 48 Minnesota counties find and access this service. We have a number of coalition partners in our efforts, which include Minnesota School Counselors Association, tribal communities, Minnesota counties, Minnesota Social Service Association, communities of faith, and also Minnesota Community Mental Health Centers. As Mark stated, we are not making the impact we need to reduce suicides, regardless of the approach we have used. Anyone killing themselves is unacceptable. A young person killing themselves is especially difficult to understand. We know that kids do not have the brain development that allows for long-range view they need to see beyond an immediate crisis. This has led to a very troubling increase in impulsive suicides, many times in response to events kids perceive as catastrophic, ones they believe they cannot overcome. Text for Life has become a lifeline in their pocket, immediately available when they most need it. When we've worked with young people to develop Text for Life, we'd hope to intervene in the most potentially lethal moments when young people are deciding to take their life or not. If we can connect with them, we can expand the 10-minute window to 20 minutes, 40 minutes, or beyond. The average texting conversation takes about 53 minutes at this point in time. During the texting conversation, positive next steps are put in place. By partnering with schools and mental health providers, we can provide them with a connection to trusted people within their community. In addition to suicidal ideation, many of the people that we are working with on Text for Life are reporting significant other mental health concerns, reporting bullying issues, and also they are discussing significant relationship issues that many times lead them to believe that their life is unraveling. Text for Life has become an extension of our current mental health system and allows a bridge to access other services such as SchoolLink Mental Health, crisis response teams, and other services that may not normally be accessed. We need to meet young people where they're at when they find themselves at the end of their hope. Minnesota has a lot of isolated people, isolated geographically in rural areas, or maybe isolated socially in the middle of a high-density urban neighborhood. I encourage you to make help available to all young people in Minnesota, wherever they may be, and for whatever challenges they may face. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And questions from members. I actually have kind of a question. Maybe one of you could answer it. I don't know, maybe Representative Sundin. Could you just walk us through a little bit how this actually works? I mean, what does this system consist of, and how do people know about it?
As far as the project had begun, Dave and staff in northeastern Minnesota really spent a tremendous amount of time going through high schools, middle schools, doing training education and rolling out and talking about the specific short code. So a short code is set out with a version that you text to it. So in this case, it's we text the word life to a particular short code. That then goes to Crisis Connection, where we receive it. We're not sitting there on phones going, so it's all computerized in terms of the texting coming in, and we track and follow the conversations that are happening with a crisis counselor with that text. If that person looks like they are in need of an immediate intervention, while that person is managing the text, another counselor is on the phone talking to 911 or the mobile crisis team trying to get an intervention set out for them. And so typically that is a cycle that we would run through. Many of the calls don't end up in that type of intervention because we're able to divert them, create safety plans, and provide other referral sources for the person who is texting to us. Does that help understand the system?
It does. It starts to, I guess. The bill actually requests a grant to a nonprofit to establish and implement this statewide. And so I'm just wondering, is this a particular piece of software that who would this be? Is this going to be through who's the nonprofit, and is it a software product that's being purchased that's a commercial product, or
those are just one component of this. So we are presently the agency Canvas Health is that's operating the software system on behalf of the Northeastern Minnesota project. So we have regulated a short code. We have a contract with an organization called EMS to get a public safety short code to operate. We are in the process of actually getting a 501c3 license to mandate that just for Minnesota, so that would be the short code used for this process here. The other part of this request is really about the education development and coordination throughout the state. There are two coordinators in the Northeastern Minnesota project whose role was to connect with the high schools and the middle schools and the communities to talk about this, to build up the support for it, to do the training, to create people within the community that we could send out as responders or have kids in this particular situation go to. This part of the grant also means creating coordinators across the state of Minnesota who would be reaching out to high schools, middle schools, colleges, universities, any place that we can get a good body of information out to them to inform them of this process. There are posters let out into schools that give you the number and remind you of what you can do. Once it's programmed into your phone, you just have to push that number and you are immediately connected to the process.
Okay. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the packet of information that we received on the bill, I just draw your attention to the incidents of suicides that occurred in each one of the states. That the heading is 2012 use by county for text for life. And I can see, an incidence in most states, except on the back page in St. Louis County, there's 1,163 incidents of suicide. If you take the population, that's 0.5% of suicides occurring in St. Louis County. I wonder if that's an anomaly or something's going on there.
Okay, Mr. Lee.
I'm sorry.
Is that
the
calls?
Those are the number of kids that have used Text for Life and have identified their geographic location. Those are kids that have actually used the service.
Okay.
So it's not kids that have completed suicide. Those are kids actually connecting to the Text for Life Center.
Is that where the program initially...
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is that where the program initially rolled out, and that's why it's so much higher than other counties in Arrowhead region?
Mr. Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are seven counties, and St. Louis County is one of the seven counties and has the 70% of the population in northeastern Minnesota.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Okay. Representative Albright.
And I wanted to follow up on the chair's question with regard to the program itself. And I note that, Mr. Lee, you're a project director. Could you just unpack your representation of the organization itself and how you're leading that a little bit?
Mr. Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Carrollton County, on behalf of a seven-county coalition and four Minnesota tribal nations, applied for a national grant. And I serve as a member of a team that actually works on behalf of Text for Life. Carrollton County has been the fiscal agent and the lead as far as writing the grant with SAMHSA. So it's part of my duties as assigned.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
I guess then just to follow on to that, to the practicality as well, you're informing the students of a code that they would use. Is there any need or costing in coordination with the cell phone providers in that neighborhood in terms of what they are responsible for in terms of any change to the billing format or any data privacy issues that they have to conform to?
Mr. Coopy.
Right now, all of the carriers in Minnesota and nationally are in support of doing this and setting aside what they are calling public health and public safety codes. And so these are a limited number of codes that they know will be used for this purpose and not commercial purposes to advertise or to gain other kinds of profit margins and things with. So they have agreed to this date. Does that hold true for 5 years from now? I don't know in terms of the telecommunications world what will happen. But for right now, that is the process that the carriers have accepted.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Other questions for members? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just maybe I missed something in your explanation of how this works, but say someone, a friend texts me, that, and so I gather that they're having trouble. Can I actually continue texting them and then connect with you so that somehow we can triangulate this?
Mr. Coopy?
You would be able to text us and let us know that that's happening, but that person would have to text us directly for them to get the service. So this, again, is a voluntary service. When they text in, they are committing to having a conversation with us. At any point in the conversation, they have the right to opt out by just texting the word stop. And then we don't pursue them unless we believe at that point they're in immediate danger. Then we would go ahead and pursue it through 911 or another action.
Representative Ward.
Thank you. It just strikes me that as kids are talking to each other that there would be opportunities for a friend to know that someone was in trouble. And maybe, you know, if I'm the friend that's being contacted and I've got your information, you know, maybe I'm not trained to really coach and counsel. I can certainly direct them to you, but is there anything else that can be done?
Mr. Coopy?
I think the beautiful part of what has happened in this particular project with SAMHSA is what Dave's group has been doing in the schools. So everybody in the school is being aware of this. There are kids groups that are being formed to talk about this. It's making the conversation about suicide something that they can talk about and that they can support each other around. They're also being told about who the counselors are, as well as different task forces have been formed in the schools where they've identified who the safe people are that they want to talk to. They're not always the school counselor or the other person. They might be the janitor, they might be the coach, they might be somebody else. But they are having those conversations within their communities, and that information and conversation allows more freedom and support for people to say, hey, remember we just had that conversation about Text for Life. It sounds like you're really struggling. Why don't you give that a try? So I think there are those pieces. Otherwise, we will also be educating people on all of the other resources within their communities about what's available for them at times of crisis.
All right. Representative Branson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, I'm curious to know if somebody makes a text to the line and it is an issue or it's found not to be an issue with the person that's doing the texting, are those individuals put on some sort of a watch list, or is there some privacy issues there that you could elaborate on?
Mr. Coopy?
First of all, again, remember this is voluntary, so they're coming into this just like a phone call would be at the crisis center. At any point they want to stop that conversation, they can. They have the right to do that. Regarding confidentiality issues, these lines are as safe as a phone line is for a crisis call at this point. What we have to remind anybody who texts with us is that they have that text conversation on their phone. And so when they leave that conversation, if they don't want anybody to see that, they need to erase that. Or they need to be cautious about who they let their phone go to. It's no different than if someone came into my mental health center and asked for their file, and I give it to them. They now are in control of that file. So texting, there is a log of that on your phone, and that's the part that people have to be aware of.
All right. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it wasn't so much the log on the phone. What I'm wondering is if wherever the texts are being sent to, where they're housed, is the individual put on a database of some sort?
Mr. Coopy.
Yes. They're, again, not by name, but by number and by zip code. So if they have texted us once, and if they text us a second time, their information will come up automatically on our screen with the previous conversation that we had with them, so that we're not starting over. We can go back with them and continue on where they've gone, what they've done in the interim since the last time we spoke to them. Did they follow up on that referral? All of those conversations can go on so that we do have that record of what's happening with them on there.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What about those that maybe share phone numbers, or they get a new phone number? Any? And then liability issues, too. Let's say you find out that, or you perceive it not to be an emergency. The individual that's sending the text decides it's not an emergency, and then, in fact, something happens. Is there a liability issue?
Mr. Coopy.
The liability issue is no different than if we were handling them on the phone or if we went out on a mobile crisis response and saw them and left. Those issues are always going to be in front, and people need to be insured to manage that part of the process. The then I forgot the first part of your question about the text, the log.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Franson.
Thank you. Yes, I was just curious about if I was the one that was doing the texting, it wasn't my phone, I was using my friend's phone type of deal.
Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Coopy, my friend is thinking of committing suicide.
Okay. The we would not know if they changed phones unless they told us. So that would not be any way that we could do that. If it's a shared phone, more often than not, we're asking them in the process of the text whether or not this is their phone. Does anyone else know what's going on about them? We go through a process of trying to inquire who they feel safe with, whether their parents are aware of this, if they're a child, if they're an adult, who's available near them that they can talk to and share this information with, if there is something that we can do to help them with that. But if they were to switch phones or share that phone and a new text came in, the new text coming in on a shared phone would show up as though it was the first conversation. And if we started that conversation with them, they might say, no, that was my sister, or that was my brother, or no, that was my friend's phone. I just took this phone to be able to do that. And then we would have to start a new conversation with them and explain the fact that we have that previous record with them.
All right. Representative Sundin, any final words before we vote on your bill?
No, Madam Chair, thank you for your time and your indulgence on this. I started this presentation talking on a personal level about my brother Kurt and some of the kids in the neighborhood that are no longer with us. And this isn't about them. This is about the lives that we can save. This is a good bill. Please pass. Move it along.
All right. So I'll renew my motion that House File 861 be recommended to pass it and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you very much for your presentation. House File 779. Representative Atkins. And I will move Representative Atkins' bill. I move that House File 779 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And no amendments. Okay.
Then, Madam Chair, to that point, I just, in fairness to this committee, there are some, as I understand it, some technical type amendments that are still in the works and that we may put on. And, Madam Chair, it's my understanding there's quite a bit of crossover between this committee and Health Finance. And I just wanted to alert the committee that that's in the works between the industry folks and the department so that we're not trying to hide the ball. It's just the language isn't quite ready yet. And then I think Representative Loeffler may have an amendment along those lines as well as a couple that might be ready for today, but one that she wants to talk about and maybe then offer in the next committee. I always feel better if I say that at prior committees so that folks don't think I was trying to pull a fast one on.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Atkins. I know, especially at this time of year, staff's busy, everybody's busy.
They're and very busy,
things
Madam
are
Chair.
Kind of in motion here. So go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've said it a few times, when you have good witnesses, the author should pretty much just keep his mouth shut. This is the market rules bill, and it's actually scaled back quite a bit from what has been theoretically talked about previous to the bill being introduced. We tried to just do the things that were really important to get done this year, and with that I will turn it over for a walkthrough to my two witnesses, one from each of the departments that has played a role in this. Okay. And whoever you want to call, I'm not sure who wants to lead off. But
welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Manny Munson Regala. I'm an assistant to the Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Health. I'll wait until the members get the handout. So we'll be working through our PowerPoint deck. All right. So some background, Madam Chair, members. As the members know, the Affordable Care Act makes a number of significant changes in the individual and small group markets, both inside and outside the Minnesota insurance marketplace. The intent of the Affordable Care Act, among other purposes, is to encourage insurers to compete on the basis of quality, value, and service instead of risk segmentation, or in other words, which risk pool is the healthiest risk pool. We also make some observations in terms of background that there are some differences in current state law between HMO and insurer regulation. So one of the purposes of our market rules bill is to ensure a consistent Well, let me start with the purpose of any health regulation in this space is to ensure that health is promoted and that consumers get protected. That's what regulation is all about, is protecting consumers.
And Mr. Regala, if I could just stop you a second, I think we need you a bit closer to the mic. I keep saying that to people. I don't know if I'm hard of hearing, but and if other people can't hear at any time, please wave at us or something. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I start speaking a little fast, which I am inclined to do when I get excited, please slow me down.
Well, market rules get us all excited.
Exactly. So the other purposes of the market rules bill are to minimize the risk of adverse selection. That's an insurance concept which says that in a world where you can buy insurance whenever you want to, you tend to buy it when you need it. As a result, the price for insurance goes up. And then lastly, we want, as we've discussed previously, to incent carriers to compete on the basis of quality and value instead of making sure that they have the healthiest risk pools. Some other goals, this is intended to respond to changes in the federal law. We wanted to be sure as much as possible it's based on the existing state law so that stakeholders knew what they were signing up for. To clarify our agency's roles and responsibilities, one of the things we're taking an opportunity to do in the market rules bill is to clarify which agency is responsible for a particular topic. And then the last thing we would note is that the implementation date for the market rules bill is January 1st, 2015. The idea is to give stakeholders some time to prepare to the extent that some of the standards are new to them. With respect to consumer protection, it's our observation that absent a uniform set of regulatory standards, you could end up with a structure where you might have three sets of rules governing the industry, one that applies to HMOs, one that applies to insurance companies, one that applies to products sold in exchange. We believe consumers are best served when there's one set of standards so that they know that the consumer protections they can rely on are the same no matter where they purchase their insurance. We also wanted to ensure that those standards that we articulated were balanced with the reasonable need for health carriers to be innovative and certainly to have affordable products available in the marketplace. So we talked a little bit about adverse selection. The Affordable Care Act does have a number of elements in it that are intended to mitigate adverse selection, and we can see that. Risk adjustment, risk pooling are intended to reduce. It's our observation that that will likely not prevent adverse selection. And we don't want to have carriers participating in the exchange be at risk of adverse selection. That makes the exchange a less attractive place to participate. We also want to make sure that risk adjustment, which is one of the things that we're going to do, is enhanced and works well. And it's our observation that risk adjustment is enhanced if you have uniform standards, so that in fact risk is recognized and appropriately. So one of the things we do is that, you know, we want to make sure that we're not the only brilliant people out there when we're thinking about this stuff. So we would note that the National Association of Insurance Commissioners makes a point that adverse selection is one of the things you wanted to think about as you promulgate market rules. And I provide you a quote from their paper talking about adverse selection. The most important thing we can do is help facilitate a level playing field between participants inside and outside the exchange. Even insurers agree on the need to address adverse selection. In a November 2011 letter written to the Maryland Exchange, Kaiser Permanente said, "The market rules must be the same inside and outside exchange. Different rules will provide incentives to game one market or the other and can provide the opportunity for adverse selection." In a 2011 Pricewaterhouse study of insurer CEOs, the number one reason that made them nervous about participating in exchange was adverse selection. And then lastly, in a stakeholder survey that the Connecticut Exchange did, Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield said, "While there are protections included in the federal law to help mitigate adverse selection in the exchange, it is important for market rules to be the same inside and outside of the exchange to further prevent adverse selection." And I've given you the links to those documents if you want to read the entirety of the document. You have a document with you. It's a list of all the work that other states have done with respect to market rules to mitigate adverse selection. I've limited them to the states that are running their own exchanges. I will excerpt some high-level samples from that sheet I've given you. Two states have concluded the best way to handle adverse selection is to have the entire marketplace be written in their exchange. We are not recommending that you have the entire marketplace written in our exchange, but that is certainly one way to prevent risk selection between markets. If you have one market, no risk segmentation. Maryland requires all carriers to participate in their small commercial exchange. If you sell small business outside the exchange, you need to sell it inside the exchange. In addition, they're the only place in their state to purchase a catastrophic level plan. Oregon's exchange is also another place where that's the only place you can buy catastrophic coverage. Washington requires plans that offer bronze plans, and those are plans with 60% cost-sharing arrangements. Bronze, the metal levels, by the way, Madam Chair and members, refer to the amount of cost-sharing that is available in a coverage. There is a relationship to price, but you could have a silver plan that is cheaper than a bronze plan, depending on the sort of the nature of the product. California requires participating insurers to sell all metal levels, bronze, silver, gold, platinum, inside and outside the marketplace. And again, the exchange is the only place to buy catastrophic coverage. With that as sort of background, Madam Chair, we're going to walk through sort of the more significant aspects of the bill. I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Alyssa Von Ruden.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Alyssa Von Ruden, Health Policy Advisor with the Department of Commerce. And as Manny mentioned, the second part of this is just talking about some of the specific areas that we wanted to address in this bill and the specific parts of those standards. These are based on ACA requirements and some things that do need to happen for plans that are offered in the exchange. The first topic area is around metal levels, which, as Manny just explained, is a way for consumers to identify the relative value of a product. So how much are they going to get out of the benefit plan that they're buying? The actuarial value is set at different levels, bronze, silver, gold, platinum. And what this bill would ask is that the exchange because the exchange already has to offer silver and gold plans, so any carrier that's offering in the exchange has to offer at least those two levels. The same thing would apply for the outside market. So this would extend to all carriers that are offering across the marketplace. Without this, carriers that are selling in the exchange could be at a disadvantage to carriers who only sell outside the exchange, particularly if they only decide to sell bronze level or catastrophic level coverage. It's a very low actuarial value, and consumers would be at a disservice to only have those plans available to them. So the next substantive area that we wanted to address was information disclosures, so looking at transparency to consumers, and this is something that, again, is already required for carriers to submit information for plans that are offered in the exchange. We would look for the transparency to extend across the market as well. There's very specific things that this bill would ask carriers to submit, which includes claims payment practices, financial disclosures, enrollment and disenrollment numbers, and cost sharing and other things that would be useful for consumers to make sure that they're making an informed choice about the products that they're getting. The other thing that this does as regulators is allows us to keep an eye on what the state of the market is. And before I give it back to Manny, there's one more area that I'll just touch on, which is marketing standards. So state law actually does have a lot of protections in place in regards to marketing standards for insurance carriers. We're pulling that into this bill to call particular attention to a couple of different things, the big part being that we don't want to see deceptive marketing practices. This isn't allowed in state law, and it isn't allowed under the ACA either. There's also a really specific requirement that marketing standards would not discourage sick people from enrolling in plans. Particularly under the new rules in the ACA beginning January 1st, when there is guaranteed issue, they can't deny you or do underwriting based on a pre-existing condition. This is pretty important to make sure that that the plans that are available are not pulling in just healthy people.
Madam Chair, members, Manny Munson-Regala again. The next substantive area of discussion is around the topic of network adequacy. Network adequacy is a concept that allows consumers to have access to a sufficient number of providers and under the Affordable Care Act to essential community providers. For 2014, exchange carriers have been asked to comply with the existing health maintenance organization standards. They happen to be the only standards that currently apply in Minnesota. HMO standards have protected Minnesotans for 20 years, but they do not apply to every carrier that participates in our state. Our proposal would extend those standards to all carriers doing business in Minnesota. Though, as Representative Atkins noted, there may be an amendment coming to allow for some clarification on the scope of that obligation.
And Mr. Munson-Regala, since you brought up the topic of amendments, we have now received three different amendments. I don't know if one of these is is the one that you're talking about, but I have here. No? Okay, there's somebody else. These are not. Never mind. Sorry. Go ahead.
The last observation we would make about network adequacy, Madam Chair, members, is that a number of states have common standards for managed care plans. Or for all carriers. One state, Texas, has somewhat different standards depending on whether or not you are an HMO, and health maintenance organization, or a PPO, a preferred provider organization. The second substantive area we want to talk about is the topic of quality assurance and improvement requirements. The ACA requires participants in exchange to implement and report on a quality improvement strategy. This section requires all participants in the Minnesota marketplace to have a quality improvement program. But for now, since we're waiting for further guidance from the federal government on the level of detail on quality improvement, we're simply collecting basic information on carriers' efforts in this area. We would anticipate that as we get further guidance from the feds, we'll likely have to come back with a technical bill to further explain what those standards are. The last substantive area we want to talk about is a concept known as accreditation. Accreditation is currently a voluntary process by which carriers go through a fairly extensive review of their business processes, claims handling, network adequacy, a number of standards that were created by consumers, by the industry, by regulators, to show that they're in fact achieving some level of enhanced quality. The ACA requires participants in the marketplace to be fully accredited. There are two recognized national accrediting entities, NCQA and URAC. We would extend this requirement to be accredited to all carriers. We do have two different timelines in which that accreditation will occur. If you're going to participate in the exchange, you have 3 years to be accredited. If you're going to be participating outside the exchange, you will have 5 years to be accredited under the current language. That is our presentation, Madam Chair. Before we conclude, I would like to echo Representative Atkins. Thank you to all of the stakeholders, the plans, the advocates, the hospitals, to on their input. I think our standards have been improved as a result, and we look forward to continuing working with them.
All right. Thank you very much for your presentation. We have a couple of testifiers on the list here, so I think if it's okay with members, let's hear from them, and then we'll take questions, and then we'll also deal with the amendments, if that's all right with everybody. So Jay McLaren, and then we've got Jen McNerney. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jay McLaren, and I'm the Director of Government Relations at Medica, which is a regional not-for-profit health plan based in Minnetonka. Today I'm testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, which is comprised of Minnesota's seven not-for-profit health plans. The Council has serious concerns with some of the contents of House File 779, and we have been working with the Department of Commerce and the author and others to see if we can mitigate some of these concerns or perhaps come to an agreement on some of these issues. We greatly appreciate them working with us on this and some of the movement that they have made with us as we've been negotiating this bill. However, we continue to have concerns with this bill, and we appreciate the opportunity to testify on it. First, I want to start off with the concern that the department talked about in bringing this bill forward around adverse selection. So just to clarify, this issue of adverse selection and less healthy people in general going to the exchange may be something that is seen in 2014, just because of the nature of the population that and their income level and different things that we know about those populations. However, the exchange itself is not at risk. The exchange is not at risk. There was even language adopted in the conference committee last night specifically calling out and stating that the exchange is not does not bear risk. It's the carriers that operate inside the exchange that bear the risk. And Mr. Munson-Ragala briefly mentioned this, but I want to touch on this and clarify it, or at least highlight it, is that according to the federal law, we are required to pool our risk for all of our individual and small group products inside and outside the exchange. So if there are generally across the carriers less healthy people coming into the exchange and more healthy outside, we are pooling them together. So I at least wanted to provide that background information for the committee just to talk about the issue of adverse selection and actually how that works, and that it's actually the carrier that's at risk.
Well, Mr. McLaren, let me just stop you right there. So isn't the real risk, I agree that the exchange itself is not going to bear risk, but isn't the risk that carriers won't want to participate in the exchange because that's where you pick up the sicker people? Isn't that the kind of risk we're talking about, or am I misunderstanding? Well, the risk is that you won't have people participating selling products in the exchange.
So, Madam Chair and members, so that is one of the elements of this, if there is not a carrier participating in the exchange, but it has to do with the number of carriers that are participating in the exchange and the market or the amount of the market that they comprise inside and out. So while it may be a business decision for a company to offer or not offer inside the exchange, or perhaps it, as you know, within the exchange bill, it may not be their option if they're able to be inside the exchange. But that what you're talking about could possibly be an issue if they are not inside. So, Madam Chair and members, on the issue of adverse selection, I appreciate your time for that. Second of all, we have concerns with some of these broader concepts of applying the requirements that are applied to insurance carriers and products inside the exchange and applying them outside, and that it may have some unintended consequences in the marketplace as well. First, we do understand why the federal government placed some of these requirements inside the exchange. If there are subsidies involved, federal dollars involved in helping people purchase coverage inside the exchange, it absolutely makes sense to place some additional requirements around quality accreditation, to apply network adequacy, to require some quality reporting. That makes complete sense, and it is a requirement of being in the exchange. However, that is known as a condition of being inside the exchange. A lot of the things that are within this bill would apply those exchange requirements outside. Carriers essentially would not have a choice to comply with these things or not, with some exceptions within the bill. For example, the metal level requirements. If a carrier offers coverage inside the exchange, that carrier, as a condition of being in there, has to offer a silver and gold level of coverage. This bill would require all carriers to offer those metal level offerings, perhaps an exception that part, but require carriers to offer silver and gold level products outside the exchange, regardless of if they participate in the exchange or not. So the bottom line is, if the consumers are demanding those products, those silver and gold products, they'll be offered. But this essentially doesn't allow the carriers to have that choice if they're not participating in the exchange. Second of all, when it comes to accreditation, so that is a requirement to be in the exchange. That's something that most of the, or a lot of the members of the Council of Health Plans already have. We already have a lot of accredited organizations within Minnesota for both public programs and for our commercial populations. So the main question behind that is, how is that going to impact? I know there's some leverage for some of the smaller carriers, but when they eventually have to comply with this, what is the impact on them? Are they going to be able to reach these accreditation requirements that they don't have to reach today? In some instances, if they're, for example, if they're indemnity plans where they don't have a network, can they meet the accreditation requirements? Those are some of the key questions, as well as are consumers today asking for more carriers that should be accredited? That's another question from the committee. So also when it comes to network adequacy and requiring those outside the exchange. So as Mr. Munson-Regala said, the network adequacy requirements that are being placed inside the exchange are existing HMO requirements. So they're applied to the different HMOs in Minnesota. However, they're not a condition and they're not applied to insurance companies. So once again, the question is, what problem is that solving? Are there current, are there complaints or are there requests to the Department of Commerce today from consumers on access to different types of providers around the state, from consumers? That's a question I would pose to the committee. There are a number of different things within the bill that touch on things that are that would exchange requirements that would be applied outside as well. But the key question is, what issue that exists in the marketplace today would be addressed by some of those requirements? Madam Chair and members, I also wanted to highlight some of the concerns that we have around the marketing requirements that are within the bill. You can find them. I can find it within the bill. So it would be on the top of page 5, or it starts at the top of page 5. We have concerns with our ability to meet even market under these requirements. For example, if you look at the bolded sentence that all carriers would be required to apply to all of our marketing materials, would we have to put this statement on the side of a bus? Would we happen to advertise on the side of a bus? I carry around a water bottle that has the word Medica on the side of it. Does this statement have to be on that water bottle?
And Mr. McLaren, where are you? What line are you on?
So, Madam Chair, if you look at line 5.15 to 5.17, it talks about how all marketing materials must contain the following language in bold print. So the question is, what is a marketing material? Those are some of the concerns that we have. I also want to highlight also within that section where it talks about on line 5.7, Madam Chair and members, when it talks about different benefit designs cannot have the effect of discouraging the enrollment of individuals with significant health needs in that plan. So I have a concern. One of the things that we do today as a plan is that we offer at least part of the coverage of a DIM membership for our members. With that language that's in the bill right now, we question if we would have the ability to do that moving forward. So quite frankly, Madam Chair, members, I appreciate the time to be able to share some of our concerns with the bill. We continue to work with the department and the author and others to address some of these issues, and once again appreciate the time to bring those before the committee.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McLaren, for your testimony. And we've got Jen McNerney. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Jennifer McNerney, and I am policy analyst with the Minnesota Hospital Association. There is a letter in your packet from us, a statement talking about our support for the network adequacy standards within House File 779. They are stronger than they were when they were originally introduced, and you know, if they were made stronger still, that would be fine with us. But I wanted to reiterate our support for that. And also our support in general for the consumer protections that are in this bill and the regulations. And that was really it. And in just in a quick response to something Mr. McLaren said, one of the reasons why the Hospital Association in particular is concerned with network adequacy and stronger and having stronger standards is because the example we give is when Medicare Advantage went into effect and people purchased plans from out of state, Medicare Advantage plans from out of state, and they did not realize that their provider was not in the provider network for that plan. They would go to their provider or the hospital and find out that they were not covered. And so just that example right there, I think, is one reason why we need stronger standards. So that's all. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. McNerney. And so, questions for members? Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, a couple questions. You know, I don't like this bill any more than I did the last one. And, you know, if I ever get a chance to do an exchange for lawyers and micromanage their thing, I am going to take advantage of it. Not that I believe in it, but
we could use all the help we could get.
Yeah, right. Oh, God. I mean, you know.
Wait for a question here.
Yeah, here it comes. Yeah.
Yes, Madam Chair.
I'm trying to keep the other stuff off to the side, but it just, you know, comes out. Okay, we were repeatedly told that in committee that the rules that applied to the exchange would not apply to plans outside the exchange other than federal law. So this bill seems to go further than that. Would you please comment as to why?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, I appreciate you pointing that out. This is actually the legislature's opportunity to take control out of and away from the health insurance exchange folks. This is a market rules bill for the entire market. So to the extent that we want to have an impact on the entire market, this is our opportunity to do that. And it bears mentioning quickly that from a consumer's perspective, and I just keep asking myself, what would the consumer appreciate? And I think to have uniform rules where, you know, you get an apples-to-apples comparison between products outside and inside. It doesn't matter whether you're shopping online or whether you're shopping outside the exchange, that you know at least on some bases that the playing field is level.
Madam Chair.
Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, I guess I see a little different interpretation. I see where you're trying to drag the market outside of the exchange, equal to the exchange, so the exchange policies don't look uncompetitive in relationship to outside of the exchange. And that's what it appears more to me that we're trying to do, rather than create a competitive marketplace outside of the exchange where we can have innovation, different types of products available that are more cost-effective in some cases and allow consumers additional choices. I mean, we're trying to create a one-size-fits-all both inside and outside the exchange, which is only going to lead to higher cost and more micromanagement by government. I mean, government seems to be moving in a direction with this bill of even further controlling and micromanaging the entire healthcare system. And that's not going to put, when government is the primary problem in the healthcare system, I don't see how expanding government's micromanagement of the marketplace is going to lead to better results in the long run, if you'd respond.
Well, Representative Grunhagen, I didn't hear a question there. I'm going to go to Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Adkins, I'm just concerned. I want to refer to Section 10. Subdivision 2. I'm not sure. Is current requirement 30 miles or 30 minutes from a provider?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, and I've got the answer. I'd ask Mr. Munson-Ragella. I think we're working on some, we've heard that concern come, and I'm just wondering if it's reflected in one of the, in any event, let me have Mr. Munson-Ragella.
Mr. Munson-Ragella.
Quickly.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, yes, it is. The current law is 30 miles or 60 for specialists.
Okay.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My concern is that you could still be within 30 miles or 30 minutes, but not be able to get an appointment for weeks or months, especially when it comes to mental health. Is that something that we can work with you on to kind of strengthen that a little bit?
Mr. Munson-Ragella.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think you have articulated one of the deficiencies that has been brought to our attention by some of the advocates, that our standards are based on quantity and not necessarily quality and access. I think we are open to dialogue with everyone around what's the best approach to ensure that when you buy a plan with a network, mm-hmm. it's a meaningful network.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just ask the question and either the author or the testifier can answer it. But I'm going to Section 6 under the middle level mandatory offerings. And I have my first question is on line 3.28, it talks about to justify the actuarial value levels, and my presumption is that to make each one of the metal levels materially distinct from one another. Mm-hmm. It also references on the next page 62Q.81. Has that section been completed yet so that we know what the distinctiveness of those metal levels is?
Ms. Von Ruden.
Madam Chair, Representative, the ACA requires the metal levels to be identified regardless of where you are in the market. Those actuarial value levels have been set through federal rulemaking already. The bronze level is a 60% actuarial value, and it goes up for each subsequent level.
Representative Albright.
I guess I'm wondering if to go beyond that and just talk about the features of the policies that would be or that would be available at that level. When would we know what is expected of the carriers for the features, or is it going to be a marketplace where they get to decide what is offered at that level?
Ms. Von Ruden.
Madam Chair, Representative, the ACA standard, first of all, is that all of the plans in the individual and small group market have to offer the essential health benefit package. So that gets to some of the features, the benefits that actually would be available. There is some requirements in the federal law as well around cost sharing, including in the small group market, very specifically deductible and out-of-pocket limits that have been set at $2,000 and $4,000. However, the other cost sharing within that and some of the other benefits that are available is what create some variation in those plans in each of the actuarial value levels.
And Madam Chair and Representative, CSIO did...
Mr. Munson-Ragala.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So CMS did issue guidance with respect to what the benchmark plan will be in Minnesota. I can provide a link to you if you'd like. Because we did not have the ability to make a choice from the various... There were four options we were given to decide what could be a benchmark, we defaulted to the largest single, largest small employer plan, which happens to be a health partners plan. So if a carrier wanted to do a Me Too filing of that plan, they would be compliant with a federal requirement to offer essential health benefits.
Okay. Madam Chair. I think we might be a bit beyond the question there. But
I just have a couple more, if you'll indulge.
Okay. We've got quite a few members on the list, Representative Albright. But go ahead, and then just if you can.
And I'm just not clear. On top of page 4, it talks about on line 4.1, it says a health plan in which the only enrollees are children. Could you elaborate in terms of what that means?
Ms. Von Roop.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is referring to a requirement that child-only plans be available in the market. It was to address a concern that previously in the individual market in many states, carriers would only offer a policy if there was an adult on the plan, and then you could put dependent children on the plan. This is actually to allow carriers to offer a plan just to a child, and that is something that the ACA requires.
Yep. May I just ask a follow-up? Thank you, Madam Chair. So, who is contracting for that policy then? If it's a minor, from the author's legal review of this, you can't bind a minor to a contractual circumstance. Who signs on behalf of the minor? I'm just trying to make sure we don't expose someone here. The child's making the choice, or the adult's making the choice on behalf of the child?
And Representative Atkins.
And Chair Liebling, Representative, that's an excellent point, but it's still a parent that signs. Yes. By basic contract law, the child can't sign, or they'd be able to get out from under the contract at any time that they want to. Okay. So it'd be voidable at the child's option, unless it was a necessity, I guess. If it was deemed that, then they wouldn't be able to, but it would be the parent that would sign it.
Okay, can we, Representative Abler?
Thanks, Madam Chair. And are we going to take up the two bills today, or is it just the rest of time for this?
I'm sorry, are we going to
take up? There's two more bills. Are we going to do those? Are we doing those tonight?
We're going to have to come back this evening. So we're going to move as quickly as we can. But I want to give this is a complicated bill, and
definitely
need to be able to discuss it.
I see there's some amendments. I don't know who those are from, but I'll just feel like I've been on this topic for a long time. We've been together for a couple days on the exchange, and it's the same discussion. I have a couple questions, but a couple comments, and I'll try to keep them short and to the point. I wish these are author's amendments. I've been talking to the people who are testifying in opposition to this. Some of these concerns have been around, and they didn't fix them yet. I'm nervous about that. But I think adverse selection is a philosophy, and I don't believe it. I don't believe what they're telling us here. I think it's a way to protect the exchange, which is supposed to be this hallmark of our work. We're trying to do a bill that makes it appealing. We're trying to find ways to minimize carriers who come in to make sure they're good enough. And I'm afraid they're not going to want to come at all. And so that's a discussion for tonight. But I do know that these changes are going to increase the cost outside the market. We've already heard the ACA is going to increase it 15 to 29% by Gruber by 2016, and that's probably optimistic. So I don't even know why we're doing this bill. I like the Senate version the best of this article, which they just took it out. But so it's not getting taken out. I have no amendment to that effect, Madam Chair. But I do have a suggestion, which was talked about in the hallway when this bill was coming up in Commerce. Some of these things are consensus, and some are very controversial. And the whole data way is 2015 that they take effect. And my suggestion to the process is that we find out what's consensus and take those things and not make the world, you know, and then ones that are controversial, we do some work in the interim and come back in January and pass those. The same people are in charge. And I, because I'm, what I'm nervous about is that these things make it even harder to make the exchange work. The whole system will be turned on its head. And right now, the outside the market is a safe harbor. And people are all nervous anyway. So many people talk to me about my locals and small businesses. They don't know what to even do. And you know that. I'm not even saying something new. But so I'll just ask this question just so I don't, and I'm guilty of just speechifying.
we would want you to do that.
Yeah. Well, I'm not trying to, but I'm just... I knew this was coming from the beginning. I said, why do you have to do this? But maybe Mr. Munson-Regala or somebody could explain to me how they plan to fix the marketing thing. Why do you have three, you have written marketing, detailed marketing, and all marketing? And tell me what's wrong in Minnesota that needs all this. We have a really good market. We're the envy of the country. So can you tell me something? I don't know. I just
Madam,
pick one question and answer, then I'll stop.
Representative.
If I might start, and then I'll turn it over to the Commerce folks. Representative Abler, it's a great question. I alluded earlier to the fact that we have been listening. There's an amendment that's in the works that just isn't quite there yet. That's why I said at the outset that we are trying to, that's a great example of something that we've got to work on. Mr. McLaren raised some points that all of which I believe are technical rather than, I mean, they come across as substantive, but most of them were just a matter of listening to the concerns from folks that are doing this in the real world. So I fully expect, and I'll let Ms. Vanderbilt from the department talk specifically about that, but we do have and expect to offer language that will accommodate that. And thank you for pointing it out.
Ms. Von Ruden.
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, what we have talked about with the stakeholders and the carriers in particular, Jay McLaren, Mr. McLaren brought up some issues with the practicality of the language of some of this, and certainly that was not the intent to make it overly burdensome for these things to go into effect. So one of the things that we've been working on with them is tightening that up and leaning the requirements, in particular in subdivision 2 of Section 8, toward the evidence of coverage or the actual contract materials that the consumers would get rather than all of the marketing materials. So that's where we're working on it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
And I'm cheering for it to get better along the way, so thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of questions, and I guess just one statement. I was trying to track the dialogue when Mr. McLaren was talking about the issue of, you know, who bears the risk and where that falls, and it seems to me that this bill might be trying to be a solution to some of the problems that might be created within the exchange, particularly with the active purchaser piece in terms of the fear of adverse selection. I don't know if the author wants to respond, and I just kind of got confused because it does seem that the exchange isn't going to be carrying the risk. The carriers are. And so if they decide to participate inside and outside the exchange, are allowed to participate in the exchange, according to the exchange board, won't it be a part of their responsibility and their business model to figure out how they manage that risk in order to spread it out and provide the product to their customers?
Representative Mack.
Madam Chair and Representative Mack, first off, I believe what Ms. McLaren noted, which is that and I fully agree with the fact that the exchange will not be a risk-bearing entity. It is not an insurance company. And to the extent that there is that sort of adverse selection, that those carriers that participate will spread that risk among the pools. I've learned that as we've gone. There is maybe we shouldn't call it adverse selection. There is an issue of whether or not people will choose to purchase through the exchange or not. And I know that some would say that this market rules bill is designed to encourage people to buy through the exchange. I get that, and for some it might argue in that favor. For me, it's more simple than that, which is that I think to the extent we have market rules, they ought to apply to every plan sold in Minnesota, whether you happen to buy it on your computer or whether you buy it in an office. From a consumer standpoint, it ought not to depend on whether or not you bought it over your computer or not. And I'm just, maybe I'm just a simple guy from Inver Grove in that respect, but it just seems so obvious to me that from a consumer standpoint, you don't want to have it be confused by the fact of whether you bought it online or in person. It shouldn't have an impact over whether or not the rules apply the same. And if the rules, if the argument is that the rules are too strict or the rules are too loose, I'm happy to have that argument. But the idea of whether it happens to benefit the exchange, it's, for me, it's got nothing to do with that as much as it is just making sure it's clear to consumers who buy this stuff.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mack.
Thank you for that. I do another point in the bill. I'm just wondering, Section 7 on the information disclosures that are being required, I'm wondering, are these required by the, I'm assuming because it's this new language, this is new just for Minnesota in this bill, or is this required by the ACA?
I'm going to leave that to one of my expert witnesses.
Okay, Ms. Von Ruden.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, just clarifying, you're talking about Section 7, the information disclosures?
Correct.
This is the language that is in here regarding the specific information that we would request is a requirement for the ACA for plans that are offered through the exchange. This bill has outlined this as a data request for all plans because for consumers, we would like to see some more transparency with the information that's available to them.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Mack.
So, if I'm reading this and understand what you're saying, this information disclosure would not just apply to the plans in the exchange. It would apply to all plans across the board from here on out. Is that correct?
Ms. Von Ruden.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, that is correct.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank
all
you,
right.
Madam Chair.
I've got Huntley, Loeffler, Grunhagen. When we get to Representative Loeffler, I think she'll probably want to offer her amendments, I'm assuming. I'd like to get that done. So, Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, I have a couple of questions for Representative Atkins, I think. One is the network adequacy requirement. The way I read this, that applies to the entire market, so that every insurance policy that's sold either inside or outside the exchange, no matter what it is, would have to meet the network adequacy requirement. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, as I understand it, yes.
Okay. And my second question is the requirement that plans outside the exchange sell a silver or gold plan. It just means the insurance company has to offer those. Is that correct? And then I got one more.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, yes.
And the other question that I have, Madam Chair, and Representative Atkins, that does not say that those insurance companies can't sell other plans outside the market that meet that don't meet the silver or gold standard. They can sell the same things they're selling today. Is that correct?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, yes. That's how you speechify with in the form of asking a question. thank you.
All right. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in the interest of time, I did have a question, but I will go right to the amendments so that we can discuss those. And first, maybe I'll offer the A9 amendment. Let's do the A8. We'll just do them in order.
All right, Representative Loeffler moves the A8 amendment.
And, Madam Chair, this deals with two separate sections of the bill, and I should first disclose that I've been working with both the Department of Health and Commerce and our staff, all of whom have been locked up in the Exchange Conference Committee, so we've had limited opportunity to work together, but so if we need a little wordsmithing on these amendments as we go along into the Finance Committee, we'll do that. But I think that the concepts work here. And the A8 amendment, the first provision deals with the issue of network where they can limit the geographic area, the service area that they would serve. And if you look on page 8, line 20, there's a number of criteria to show that you're not discriminating based on race or ethnicity. In rural Minnesota, concentrated poverty is also associated with higher than average health care costs and health disparities. And, you know, and so this would just say you couldn't carve out a part of a county to, for example, keep out the trailer park that might have a lot of really exceedingly low-income people, that sort of thing. And so that's the first part of the amendment. The second part of the amendment all has to do with limited scope dental plans. And I didn't know what a limited scope dental plan was. That seemed like a new term of art, and I couldn't figure out if that was tooth pulling only or what it was. And I had the opportunity to talk with our state agency people. And in the Affordable Care Act, health plans are required to offer pediatric dental coverage to a certain level. And that's what the intent of this is. So what this does is just add the word pediatric, so it would be limited scope pediatric dental plans. So we actually know kind of a little bit more what it's focused towards. And because in this committee we have often talked about the interplay of dental and physical health, we've actually even authorized in certain instances pediatric providers to do dental sealants because of the shortage of access to dentists in some areas and the value of that. It just suggests that the Commissioner of Health should recommend ways in which to encourage coordination so that if a, you know, so that people think about that as they're making health plans decisions, so that if their primary care physician's office has already put sealants on, the dentist know that. Maybe they can tell it by looking at the teeth. I'm not a dentist. But the concept was just to make this clear. And with that, I'd answer questions.
Yeah, and I have one, Representative Loeffler. So on your amendment, say, for example, on line 1.3, mm-hmm. it says you've got page 9, line 1, delete scope and insert pediatric. Oh. Is that what you explained? You were adding a word, and the amendment says delete.
Right. Madam Chair, I would defer to our House counsel because I think I had actually set it up as to add pediatric, and the scope may not add a whole lot. But I think either way, my concept is just to get the pediatric in there so it narrows it to what this really applies to.
All right. Well, let's hear from Representative Atkins first and see whether he's amenable to this at all. And if he is, then maybe we'll have to tweak it or not. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler. I am amenable to the, and I believe in visiting with the department folks, they are as well. So if council can help in that respect, we'd appreciate it too.
Okay. Mr. Chun or whoever, I don't know who drafted the amendment. Ms. Cleveland, did you draft the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, if you don't want to replace scope with pediatric and you want it to say limited scope pediatric, then on line 3 of the A8, we would delete the word delete and replace it with after. And you can also delete and. And then on line 4, delete the word delete, replace it with after, and you can delete and. So it would read after scope, insert pediatric on both those two lines.
Okay. Did members get that? Ms. Sando, I hope, got that. Let me just repeat it. So we're on the A8 amendment on line 1.3. We're going to delete the word delete and insert after. And then after the word scope, we're going to delete the word and. On page 1.4, we're also going to delete the word delete, insert after, and delete the word and. Okay? Any discussion to that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then I would like to move the A9 amendment.
So Representative Loeffler moves the A9 amendment.
And, Madam Chair, this deals with essential community providers, which is something we actually have in current law. I don't know if it's unique to Minnesota. As I understand it, it's not necessarily intertwined with the Affordable Care Act. But as written right now, it might be a little broader, and we can continue to work with the affected groups on the language. But you'll note on line 10.10, it says a hospital or health systems whose inpatients are predominantly under 21 years of age. And when I inquired with House research staff about the definition of health system, what's actually only defined right now in law related to electronic medical records, and it might be interpreted, I thought, to, for example, include the whole Fairview University system when maybe the intent was the Amplatz Children's Hospital. And since you get some really nice benefits by being designated an essential community provider, I felt like we should narrow it down to what I think was the intent, which is our specialty children's hospitals that do unique services that children all throughout the state benefit on. And so the intent of this is just to make sure that it's for those unique pediatric services that are in those hospitals, and that they have all testified, as far as I know, that they serve children from throughout the state. We may, and so this, because I think the way the amendment was originally written, it would actually expand the scope beyond what the intent was, and we may need to finesse it a little bit, but that's the intent of this amendment.
Okay, and thank you, Representative Loeffler, and Ms. Cleveland has given us a little correction here, and it would be to, on line 1.2 of the A9 amendment, to delete the word health and insert hospital. So if you'd like to incorporate that into your amendment.
I would be glad to, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Huntley.
I just have a question for the author of the amendment. Gillette Children's Hospital has offices all over the state. And so there it is a system. And would this prevent them from doing what they're doing in the outside of the St. Paul area?
Representative Block.
Madam Chair and Representative Huntley, that's not my intent, but it's also not my intent to have non-specialty services provided, because they just happen to be kids that live in the neighborhood of Minneapolis Children's, for example, to be covered. So we may need to clarify this a little bit, and I will work with the children's hospitals before I go to finance to make sure it covers that. But I think the way it's written right now, it just will pick up a lot more than was the intent. The intent is to make sure that people have access to the good specialty services that that these hospitals have developed, and the appropriate follow-on. And we may need to refine it, but right now I felt like it was picking up some people we didn't intend to pick up.
All right. Representative Atkins, do you want to make a comment on this amendment?
Madam Chair, and to the amendment, I don't necessarily disagree with the thrust behind the amendment. I don't quite know yet if it's drafted exactly the way it's supposed to be or even is desired to be, but the original those folks that brought me the amendment, I think, might want to be heard briefly on what they think the impact may be, if that's all right.
Okay. We can do that, Representative Atkins. I want members to know, though, it would be great if we could get to a vote on this bill. We have 5 more minutes in this committee, so if we can, maybe we can do this very quickly. Welcome to the committee.
Yes, hi. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Kelly Wolf with Children's Hospitals and Clinics. Representative Loeffler, I appreciate the amendment and the intent. Certainly when we brought this forward was to make sure that we had access to pediatric specialty care. And I do think we have a couple concerns the way that this language is written, in particular the deletion of the what's now been amended to say hospital system. I think if there's a way to make sure that we say hospital and the hospital's clinics, because the way that the amendment is written, my concern is that this would now not apply to our outpatient clinics. And children's outpatient clinics do serve a disproportionately high percentage of Medicaid patients. And we do have our hematology, oncology, and our diabetes clinics that do serve those specialty pediatric services. So, again, I appreciate the intent, and I understand what's trying to be done here, but I think the deletion of the system part, the hospital system part, may in fact make it so that our clinics would then be excluded as well. So it may just be a simple solution as including on line 1 point, let's see, or reinserting hospital on the original bill, hospital or the hospital's clinics, instead of system.
All right. So, Madam
Chair, I have an oral amendment that I think will address this then. And on line 1.2 of the amendment, it would add, so after you delete hospital system, it would say, and add affiliated specialty clinics. Because their intention was not my fear, which was to have the entire Fairview system or university system covered. They have a legitimate question about the affiliated specialty clinics, and I think that addresses both.
Representative Loeffler, my preference would be that we not wordsmith this right here in committee when we're under time pressure and so on. This is going right to finance, and I would feel more comfortable if you could continue, you and Ms. Wolf, and maybe Representative Atkins, if he can give you a moment of his time, that we make sure that we get this right so that if we're going to put it on the bill, it might as well be the right language.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm glad to. I would have actually consulted with them, but we had to do this literally in the middle of the night after the exchange bill conference committee wrapped up, and I was exchanging emails with the state agency staff trying to understand the words. And the last amendment I'm not going to even offer, but I want to, at least since this is the policy committee, alert people to the bill right now in terms of accreditation. When we went through the exchange bill, we promised and assured everyone that we'd have, you know, high standards and that we'd, you know, get everybody up to it and assure them. And the way this is worded right now, it has the opportunity for carriers who are to avoid making progress potentially for quite some period of time, and that is not the intent. Full accreditation is a multi-year process, I've been told. So some that have not stepped up to do that ahead of time may not, but we need some assurance in the language that they're actually making progress and that we can give the commissioner some authority to work with the carriers to assure that they're not just out there offering products for 6 years and not making any effort to meet what we expect in Minnesota.
All right. And Representative Loeffler withdraws the A9 amendment. So Representative Grunhagen is on the list, and then...
Madam Chair, let's vote, I think.
Okay. Representative Atkins, final word from you?
It's a good bill. It's a work in progress as well, and we'll keep working on it, and I appreciate your support.
All right. So I will renew my motion that House File 779 be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
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 The motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Division, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members.
Division, Madam Chair.
I think we're a little too late. Okay, we can do a division. All right, all those in favor?
By roll call, Madam Chair?
Well, no, it's too late for roll call. We voted. All those in favor? Opposed? There being 11 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails. And we stand in recess. We are going to come back this evening. The committee is going to recess to the call of the chair. We'll reconvene at either 6:30 or 15 minutes after floor session in room 10. Note, members, we're in room 10 of the state office building this evening. We stand in recess. Committee will come to order. We are going to hear House File 886. Representative Fritz, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like to move my bill.
Okay, Representative Fritz moves that House File 886 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And Representative Fritz, you have an A1 amendment, it says here.
Yes, the A1 amendment.
And
Madam Chair?
Representative Grunhagen.
Is there any implication that we don't have a quorum here?
We are, since we're continuing committee, we do not, we have a quorum continuing from earlier. So the A1 amendment is your amendment, Representative Fritz?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Fritz moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which she would like to discuss it. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, I guess I'd request a quorum
committee, the call of the quorum committee. I mean, it just seems if it's an important piece of legislation, we should at least have a certain amount of committee, and maybe we need just a recess for 5 minutes to see who shows up here.
Well, Representative Grunhagen, we're not going to vote on the bill until we get a few more members here, so I think we can let Representative Fritz start discussing her bill. Representative Fritz.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. And I'll be somewhat brief, but I'm very pleased that to be here and to present House File 886, which has been a long time coming. House File 886 will provide a much-needed investment in the two key pieces of our long-term system, the nursing homes and the elderly waiver programs. I know we will focus on the investment piece of this bill in the the Finance Committee, but let me take a minute to discuss three reasons why this needs to be a priority this year before turning it over to the testifiers. Number one, we are getting older. Boomers are turning 65 at a rate of 10,000 per day across the nation. By the year 2020, Minnesota will have more seniors than school children. We have to get prepared for this change. Aging is not a partisan issue. In fact, it might be the one thing we all have in common. And chances are that if we live to the age of 65, and I'm already past that, we will require some form of senior care. As Minnesota ages, we will need more caregivers. We need to start investing in caregivers to ensure that we have enough to take care of our aging population. Second, senior caregivers are underpaid, plain and simple. Because so much of our senior care funding is controlled by the state, it is up to us to invest in these services so that caregivers can get wage increases. How will we attract the caregivers we need if we don't pay them a competitive wage? It has been 4 years since the time payment rates for senior care were increased, and consequently, 4 years since, many of our caregivers have had a wage increase. Caring for our seniors is a Minnesota value. We all want to grow old with dignity and independence and be able to get the care we need in our senior years. We need to honor our seniors by ensuring that they have access to quality long-term care services. I am joined today by two testifiers. We had four, and actually one who was a person in the business of caring for others had worked the night shift last night and is now preparing to go for the night shift and work tonight again. So she is a wonderful caregiver and a great, great testifier. So I'm sorry that we don't have her here. But we do have two folks that are with us, Toby Pearson from Care Providers, and I'm going to turn it over to him, and then Carrie Thurlow from Aging Services. And I also want to say that in the 9 years that I've been coming to this table asking for rate increases and talking about this, this is the first time that we're all together. We're all together. We're a force. And I really feel that on this bill, this is a very bipartisan bill because both Democrats and Republicans have heard, I think, from their nursing homes and their workers and the people that they care for in their districts. So I'll turn it over to Toby.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Toby Pearson, today with Care Providers of Minnesota, testifying with Carrie Thurlow and Aging Services. Together, we are the long-term care imperative at the Capitol. You, as Representative Fritz did mention, you do have letters of support from several different organizations. This is a very bipartisan bill. Many of you are co-authors on the bill, and it has support from both the union folks as well as AARP and several other associations. For years, senior care providers have deferred needed investments, particularly in the area of staff wages and benefits. This was the result of 4 years of freezes for most providers and double-digit cuts to elderly waiver. The proposal in front of you is an attempt to partially address these critical funding needs. The central element of the request is a cumulative rate increase worth up to an average of 5% for both nursing facilities, as well as elderly waiver providers. The bill breaks down this way. For nursing facilities, there's a 2% base increase to address general cost increases. For both staff-related and other costs that have been frozen from since 2009. A 2% increase is available for participation in advancing excellence. This portion of the increase would go to nursing facilities that have to show that they have signed up for a program and working on quality improvement goals. It's a prospective method that allows the facility to localize the goals and work to achieve them. The reward comes for demonstrating improved organizational and clinical outcomes. 1% increase available for investment in critical workforce needs. Uses include adding staff, reducing wage gap for caregivers, or addressing growing benefit costs. Both the workforce as well as the base increase are encumbered at 73%. For the elderly waiver section, it breaks down this way. 2% base increase to address general cost increases. Again, both staff-related and other costs have increased while the reimbursement rates for elderly waiver have been cut repeatedly for the last several years. Funds equivalent to a 2% increase are also available for participation in a quality improvement program, and 1% increase available for investment in critical workforce needs, mirroring exactly what happens with the nursing home side. That's an overview of the bill, and I will pass it on to Carrie to walk through the need, and I will stand for questions at the end.
Carrie Thurlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Oops, excuse me, Madam.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm with Aging Services of Minnesota and appearing here with Mr. Pearson on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I first want to thank Representative Fritz for her leadership on this issue. She definitely has been fighting for a long time in support of senior care providers and our staff, and we really do appreciate that. I do want to spend a few minutes discussing the reasons why this bill is so important, and I think Representative Fritz really did outline the reasons very well. In your packet, you have a document with four slides and labeled the crisis in long-term care that really outlines some of the challenges that providers are facing today as a result of the four-year rate freeze for nursing facilities and the double-digit cuts to the elderly waiver program. And before I walk through those very quickly, you're going to hear us discussing, and you've heard me say this before in committee, that this is in fact addressing two components, kind of the backbone of our long-term care system, both nursing homes and the elderly waiver program. Both are very critical for meeting the needs of our seniors today and in the future. And both are suffering today due to insufficient funding. If you look at the first slide, you'll see the one element of our long-term care system that gets a lot of attention every year in and year out, which is our care centers. You'll see that approximately 85 nursing facilities in Minnesota today are facing financial crisis. That places more than 12,000 jobs at risk. Remember that lawmakers here in Minnesota, as well as at the federal level, controls the majority of nursing home budgets. Over 80% of their operating budgets are tied to government programs such as Medicare and Medicaid. And so really you have a lot to do, a lot to say about addressing this particular issue. The next slide really demonstrates how this is impacting our workforce needs. And day after day, as we go out and survey our members, the number one thing challenge that they face today is recruitment and retention of their own of quality staff in their settings. And this is the primary reason why. An RN today in a senior care setting makes about $32,000 a year less than an RN in a hospital setting. It's directly tied to the reimbursement rates that we have. Nursing assistants also make almost $13,000 a year less in a senior care setting than a hospital setting. But it's not just healthcare settings that we're competing with. We're competing with other businesses out there, from everything from Menards to Walmart to other businesses, making it very difficult for us to have the caregivers in this field to meet the growing demand for senior care services. The next slide will show you the turnover rates that we're facing. Even in this economy, when people are looking for jobs, we are having high turnover rates. and that necessarily affects the continuity and quality of care that we're able to provide our seniors. And again, it's tied to the wage disparities we have, and it's tied to the low reimbursement rates that we have. Our providers time and time again say that they want to provide something for their caregivers, that 4 years has been too long, and that they need to start providing something to their caregivers so that we're able to attract and retain our quality staff. The last slide just simply discusses the rate changes over the last 4 years, and I think sums it up pretty well. And so again, thank you, Representative Fritz, for bringing this bill forward, and we look forward to support from this committee and continued discussion on this important issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gruhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
You always do a good job.
Thank you.
No, I want to thank Patty Fritz for Representative Fritz for bringing this forward. It is a critical issue. I believe I'm a co-author on there. And thanks for letting me sign on. And the I have visited with my nursing home people in the rural district, and they basically confirm everything you've said. In fact, she said some of her best employees are leaving because they haven't had a raise in over a decade. And, you know, but so I certainly want to see that go up, okay, because obviously it's a difficult job. Not a lot of people want to do it, and yet it desperately needs to be done for the care of the people that are in that situation. I had a father-in-law 12 years in a nursing home with Alzheimer's, and he couldn't feed or dress or toilet or, you know, he had the five dependencies or six, and it was a very depressing situation. He's passed away now. But my question that I get from so many people is, how can there not be enough money when they're getting $5,000 a day, $5,000 a month, let's just say, for one person in the room, and another $5,000 for the other person? So you got two people in a room, and the nursing homes each charging $5,000. What happens to all that money? Okay. It, you know, and people ask me, well, how can they be short money when they get that much? And I know Medicaid underpays, but do you have any input on that?
Well, it's not going to wages.
So. I know. So where is it going?
Well, you know, I, you know, when we talk to our nursing home administrators who don't own the facilities, yep. they manage the facilities, and I've seen both all sides of this, you know, and I believe that you know, there are some companies that are buying up nursing homes. Here's when you're getting 10,000 people a day throughout the nation turning 65, the light bulb goes on. Where are they going to go? So you should, you know, probably invest in some nursing homes. I would think that, but you know, I think it can turn around. I think we've been flat for way too long. Yeah. And you know, I'm sure that your nursing home administrator or folks that own them would be happy to show you their spreadsheets. It's upkeep. A lot of these facilities are very, very in need of boilers, windows, roofing. I mean, I visited many of them with our task force a few years ago. The whole state, there's work that needs to be done, and they put that off because they can't afford it. And the cost takes, you know, I had parents in the nursing home too at $4,000 or $5,000 a piece. And it does go for, you know, the little bit of wages that we get, the management, and then the upkeep on the facilities and the cost of the food and everything. There's a high cost there.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Representative Gray.
Yeah, I know it's a 24/7 job. It just, anyway, you're probably right. I need you just to go there and look at their books once and decide for myself. I've talked to them before, but anyway. Hey, appreciate the response. Appreciate you bringing this bill. It's desperately needed, and otherwise we're going to have more of these nursing homes closing, especially in the rural area. They can't sustain themselves.
And one more.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don't we deserve quality care in our aging, you know? Good quality care? And there's a cost to that. We're worth it. And improvement. And that's what, you know, we've been, you know, in the back seat on this way too long. So I hope that we can have the dignity of having quality care.
Yeah, and Matt, Madam Chair.
Representative Gruhagen.
Not to drag this out, but I agree with you 100% because I know the people actually taking care of the patients are the ones that are underpaid. But it still makes you wonder where the rest of that money goes. But thank maybe you. It goes to investors. I don't know. Anyway, I'll find out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there any other questions from the member? Does anyone in the audience would like to testify for or against? Seeing none, Representative Fritz renews her motion that House File 886 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No. Motion passed.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Our next bill to be heard is House File 766. Representative Loeffler, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, I'd like to move House File 766. And I have an amendment, an A1 amendment.
Okay. Would you like to move your A1 amendment to get it, the bill in the shape in which you would like it?
Yes, and this just clarifies some of the wording that was in the original version.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? So moved. Okay. Representative Loeffler, would you like to explain your bill?
I would be delighted to, Madam Chair. Hennepin County launched a very successful pilot project a year ago, targeted at our most challenging and costly populations within our health and human services system. And it's doing it by integrating all the components of the Hennepin healthcare and human services system by getting our hospital, HCMC, our health plan, Metropolitan Health Plan, North and HCMC's 8 outpatient clinics, North Point and Wellness Center, which is a federally qualified health care center located in North Minneapolis, and our county human services and public health departments all working together to coordinate the services to reduce the cost of a population that faces many, many challenges. And it has, so far in its first year, reduced emergency room visits, reduced prescription drug costs, improved medication compliance, reduced administrative duplication, and really knit the system together to better provide for integrated care and support. In your packet, there's a list of accomplishments by quarter. I have been involved in all kinds of pilot projects and studies over my career, and I have to say I haven't seen one that has had so much really accountable efforts month after month in implementing this. This bill would create opportunities for Hennepin Health to increase its enrollment. It started with a cap on its enrollment because it was a new effort. We weren't sure how big it would be. And we're realizing that we need to look at the possibility of adding other segments of the population who can benefit from this integrated work. We think we can demonstrate some ability to serve a better population. It will also help sustain the administrative infrastructure that's associated with this by putting more people into the program, and the bill authorizes DHS to work with us on doing that. To tell you a little bit more about this, I have a witness, Russ Owen, who's been heavily involved in the management of this program, and would welcome him to the committee.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Owens. Would you introduce yourself for...
Good evening. I am Ross Owen. I am the product manager for Hennepin Health, and I'll make my comments very brief. As was discussed a moment ago, Hennepin Health is really a unique way of delivering health care in a way that aligns the financial incentives among the partners that Representative Loeffler named. We are seeing encouraging decreases in emergency room use and in hospitalizations, which before Hennepin Health would have just been lost revenue to Hennepin County Medical Center. And now those are savings that can be reinvested in the system to create further efficiencies and further improve the outcomes and drive down the costs of care. This language would remove the cap on total enrollment, as well as remove the specific naming of the Medicaid early expansion population, of which our entire membership today is comprised. And this is a model that we think is working, and we're hoping that this legislation, should it move forward, will give us additional flexibility to negotiate with DHS to bring additional Hennepin County residents into this model to improve their care in a way that doesn't conflict with the authorizing statute.
Thank you, Mr. Owens. Is there any questions from the members? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none.
Madam Chair, I believe we have to formally adopt the amendment before we can make the final motion. Do we? Someone said we had to, so I was following up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Seeing that there is no other questions, Representative Loeffler renews her motion that House File 766 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion moved.
Thank you, Madam
Chair.
Committee.
And committee is adjourned. Thank you.
One more guy.